Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September the 7th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Ed Schrader, and he will be speaking on Why Jesus and Not Just Therapy to Make and Keep Me Healthy, Part 2.
This is the third session of a sequence this week, asking the question, why Jesus? Why is Jesus necessary, especially in our day here in the United States, when there seem to be an awful lot of alternate offerings for healing and for helping us get well, maybe not get to heaven, but at least surely to take care of our problems? I've specified three to look at, namely therapy, the psychiatric healing and counseling profession. We started that on Tuesday, and now we're picking it up again. And tomorrow's first session, we'll take a look at another big, important world religion, Buddhism. And the last session will then focus on ethics. Why do you need Jesus to have good ethics? Because many of you, I suspect, know people who aren't Christian who are good folks. You know, honest, they don't cheat, and they're even dedicated to justice and many of the good causes. So, why Jesus? And not just therapy to make and keep me healthy, and answer a clue from the epistle to the Hebrews. Since a number of you, most of you, said you were not present at the Tuesday one, I'll at least just try to recite the Hebrews part, remind those of you who were here. The letter to the Hebrews is a distinct letter in the New Testament, in that it frames the whole story about Jesus, or the whole presentation about Jesus, in terms of the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible's way of, not way, the Hebrew Bible, I shouldn't say that, the Old Testament Jewish act of worship at the Jerusalem temple. And from that Old Testament picture, which takes both the very architecture of the temple as a important sort of blueprint for discussing Jesus, and also the action of the priests from the tribe of Levi. And in the letter to the Hebrews, and we don't know who wrote it, there's never any hint of who the author was, in that letter, the author says, with reference to the architecture of the Hebrew temple, let me remind you, dear readers, and those readers must have been Jewish people who would have known that by heart, that there was this super holy inner place, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and that was so holy that only one person, one time a year, ever went in there, and he, the high priest, had to be purified and go through all sorts of rituals to sort of get himself clean, so that he could, on one day of the year, and that day is coming up in just a few days in the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, that he would then go in there with the blood of a unblemished animal, you know, a pure, clean animal, and throw that blood on this Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was actually structured like a chair, a throne, but there was no person sitting on the throne, because of course God is invisible and you can't make a picture of the true God anyhow. Remember the first commandment, make no graven images. And this seat or throne later on got to be called the mercy seat, or at least in the book of Hebrews, he calls it that, the mercy seat, or even the throne of grace. Those are just synonyms, you know, a chair where grace or mercy is. There were not only these sort of two architectural structures inside, and only the high priest could go to the inside one. Other priests did their work and sacrifices out here, but then there were subsequent expanded courts where the less holy you were, the farther away you had to stay. And but the Hebrews writer just focuses on this inside, and he says what happened. Oh, that's one thing. And then he says, now the Levitical priesthood, he describes how that works. They held it once a year, and that person had to be super clean, and he always came in here with the blood of a goat or a heifer, an animal, and splashed the blood. But he had to do it year after year after year after year. You know, every year in Yom Kippur. And if there were a temple in Jerusalem today, you know, 1995, which there isn't, the Orthodox Jewish people would do that again. Somebody would be found to be the high priest, or maybe there's still one of the descendants of the Old Testament priests, and that person would be designated to do that. But since the Levite priest, the Levitical priest, had to do it over and over and over again, that shows that it didn't stick, you know, that it wasn't lasting. Whatever he did to bring sacrifice in and to somehow bring mercy back out for the people was never good enough to last. It was not permanent. And in fact, since it was just the blood of an animal, you knew, and even the Old Testament people knew, that that animal blood was sort of a pointer, a signal. The letter to the Hebrews, the writer there says it was really a shadow of something, of the real thing that was someday yet to come. And then the Hebrew writer says, we Christians know who the real one was, the real Lamb, capital L, you know, whose blood opens the gate to bring us to God's mercy and bring God's mercy back out to us. So that's the way he uses the imagery both of the temple architecture and of the priestly action. Now, there are 13 chapters in the book of Hebrews, so there's a lot more about that, but that's sort of the basic blueprint on which the whole thing operates. And this letter is written to Christians who today, we might say, need to see a therapist. They are people who are either, if not in despair or in depression, they are people who are just, you know, down in the mouth and sad and just exhausted. Maybe we'd say burnout is what they're suffering today, although burnout's not a very precise diagnosis. But they seem to be ready to say, we've been at this Christian business long enough, and it's a tough road to hoe, and it's a long way to go, and we can't see where it's all going to end. We think we ought to just quit and turn off the road and go someplace else. So he presents the long journey, but uses then the good news about Jesus and says, look, you people know that in Jesus, the real mercy seat of God, the God who sits in heaven, not just in this structure down there in Jerusalem, that mercy seat is wide open now because of Jesus, because of him taking his own blood, if you will, and putting it on the altar of sacrifice. And now that curtain that used to always be in the Jerusalem temple, always here, and could only be gone through once, Jesus has torn that curtain wide open, and it's never going to be closed again. Not in the actual building in Jerusalem, although you may remember on Good Friday what happened to the temple in Jerusalem.
The veil was torn down.
That veil, that curtain that kept it off, that was ripped wide open. Obviously a signal from God himself, if you will, that what was going on Good Friday was opening it wide up. You know, not just that anybody could go into that room, but that all of us could finally go to God and say, God, I'm a sinner, but I understand the door's open for mercy and forgiveness. And Jesus is the one who did it. And since God raised Jesus from the dead, says the letter to the Hebrews, that shows that God approved of that. That God said, yeah, what my beloved son did in ripping it open and offering it over, I verify that. I authorize that. I confirm that with my thumbprint as I raised him from the dead. And so forever after, it's wide open. And the writer said, so come on, you kids, you guys and gals, you brothers and sisters, don't get tuckered out and say, God must have forsaken us. The gate for mercy and for forgiveness and for resources is wide open. So even though you're tired and pooped and run down, go back and go into that door again and get some more resources so you can keep on going. Because Jesus himself is on this path. Remember, he was the pioneer, the guy up front who started it. And he's even the guy riding shotgun in the back, the finisher. And so we're really protected on both ends on this long journey. And besides, we've got this great cloud of witnesses. You may remember that chapter. Chapter, what is it, 11?
Or 12?
12. And he runs the long list of other great saints of the Old Testament who had the same kind of experience. You know, they were asked by God to go on long journeys to God's promise, and they too got tuckered and plumb and tired out and burned up, But God kept them alive, God kept them going, and he'll keep us going too, because we've got the mercy seat, the door's wide open. We've got access. Okay, that's the good news according to the Hebrews writer. So with the handout sheet that I gave you, if you can, are there enough to go around? I only made about 20 or 30, that's not it. Here, John, you should just have one. Who doesn't even have one to look at?
It's the half sheet.
It's a half sheet. If you don't have one to look at, hand it back. If somebody's got one, some more. We got a couple extras to share. If you want one, I can run one off the computer yet this evening and get it to you. But just if everyone can at least have access to see one. Now, at the end of yesterday's session, since John, the book manager, store manager, is here, at the end of Tuesday's session, after I got done with this little rerun of Hebrews, what I've just done with you, and I talked a fair amount about Freud, John had a couple of comments that might even have been complaints. And if John, if you're willing to kind of lay them out on the table, and also, or the table, I guess that's right, the table, whatever, the mensa, the circle, and put into the mix what you wish would have gotten into the mix last Tuesday already, so we've got that going with us as we move ahead.
Okay. Well, last Tuesday, if my memory serves correctly, you had a diagram up of there of the superego, the ego, and the id. And before that, you had up there the gospel, and you call this the gospel. Okay, so the first thing I can't agree with is that anything that Freud said or anything that any other psychologist said is gospel. In the first place, psychology is a science. Treatment of people combines what scientific observation has shown them, and they are people with whom I would say are artists as well as scientists. It's a craft, a skill. But a therapist should never set himself or herself up as speaking gospel to people. Another thing you said was that the goal of psychoanalysis was to destroy the superego. And you described, I believe, the superego as that part of our internal psyche that is God. That is not the way Freud has discussed it or described it. I've got this right from the Encyclopedia Britannica. I've done a little bit of research.
You're dangerous, John. I think I'm going to get out of here. Go on.
Freud described the superego as the inhibitions of instinct characteristic of man. So there was no discussion there of God, there's no discussion there of gospel. Rather, I believe that Freud was a brilliant man who, through observations of behavior, delved into such things, scientific words, as hypotheses and formulated theories. I didn't know, and I still don't know, whether Freud ever said that the goal of therapy would be to destroy the superego. However, I do concur with you now that I found this other handy-dandy little book. This is by Carl Menninger, highly regarded therapist, and this was written way back in 1958. And I'm sorry to be pedantic, but I'll just read this a little bit.
You're not the only one in this room.
So, there was certainly a notion around that that could be the goal of therapy, as Menninger indicates here. The fate of the superego in the analyzed patient has been much discussed in the literature. For a long time, it was held that having been projected upon the analyst, it was gradually but completely eliminated, and its function replaced by conscious judgment and perhaps a strengthening of the ego ideal. It was more or less assumed that the superego was destroyed and disappeared with the separation from the analyst. It is pretty well agreed now that this was oversimplified and extreme. Indeed, some patients seem to demonstrate an increased strength of the superego after analysis. It is really naive to think that value judgments and attitudes can be left to pure reason. Many of them have to be made and will continue to be made unconsciously at the behest of the superego, which should be considered a useful device causing trouble only when it is ill-formed and ill-functioning. So, and it's interesting to note that Freud himself, maybe an illustration from his own life would indicate the struggle he had with his superego, because he was very much in love with his mother. And in fact, the criticism of Freud usually is that his theories are based too much on that personality and behavior are based on sexual urges. He loved his mother. When his brother came along, he felt very jealous and upset. And it was only, I think it was 8 weeks or 8 months after his brother was born, the brother died. So he went around all his life, or for a very long time in his life, feeling that these feelings, which by the way would be inhibited by his superego, may have had something to do with the death of his son.
His brother.
Or his brother.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. So I think, so again, I don't know whether Freud ever said that the superego was to be eliminated. I don't think he did. I also say the superego is much more than God, and Freud, who was an agnostic, said it was something intrinsic within us, so that there is something within us, innately within us, that causes us to pull back from doing something that our feelings may be insisting that we do, like killing our brother. The other thing is that today, I mean, if you set up Freud as a person who had a lot of influence, he certainly did have a great deal of influence, but a person that I would think would generally be acknowledged now by people in psychology, people that are doing treatment, is the contribution of B.F. Skinner. That much of the therapy that's being done today is behaviorally based. It doesn't even delve into questions of the soul. And I guess what I'm saying here is that you can safely use the services of a therapist. The therapist can help us, and we never even get into the matter of forgiveness, of Christ, of matters of the soul. Essentially, I guess that's all I have to say.
Well, thanks for that. And you also said one more thing. You said, Ed, you never got around to answering the question. So truth in advertising. Well, would you pick up that one again? And the answer you gave me when I said, I think you're right, John, what would you have said would be the right answer that I never gave at all?
Yeah, well, the answer that isn't dealt with by psychologists is that we don't talk about the gift of forgiveness, which is the gift that Jesus gave us.
In your own experience, and I guess I'd ask others to try to pull those two together a little bit. First of all, thank you for that first hop, skip, and jump, but summary of some Freudian stuff that I was very, not blasé, just very casual and quick, too quick about. But are there any psychiatrists, any therapists who do, or have you had experience with therapy where getting into the realm of forgiveness was indeed what happened?
Yeah, I do counseling.
Uh-huh.
And the clients that I have come in, what I try to do is to find out the areas that they want to work on. And I usually point out four: the physical, the mental, the emotional. And I kind of pause on the next one and I say, if you want, the spiritual.
Uh-huh.
And then I let them tell me where they want to go with the spiritual. Because some will get up and walk out if you bring in the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
So I say, if you want to open that up, that's fine. You can do that. We can go with it wherever you want.
Okay, anybody else with an observation or some of your own experience? And some of you may well be involved in, you know, counseling and therapy, not just as patients, but even as practitioners, because I don't really know what you all do. Well, okay, if at the moment we get silence, maybe the handout, the sheet that I've just handed out, which I want to get to in a few minutes, not just because I've got Freudian agenda anxiety, but what I did, since John had said a little bit of this to me after Tuesday's session, I said, I'm going to stay away from Freud and let John do the clarification on that, if he could come. I wasn't sure whether John could get out of the bookstore over there quick enough and at least make the contribution that he just did. And instead, pick up John's second, you might say, complaint. You never did get around to answer the question, why Jesus? We took a quick look at the end of the letter of the Hebrews, and I've kind of just rehearsed that here a few minutes ago for those of you who are new, and never even got around to saying, what is Hebrews' answer to why Jesus? And what you said yesterday, and I've not, or the day before, and I've just repeated, is exactly what the letter of the Hebrews says. Why Jesus? Apart from Jesus, at least the Hebrews writer says, we got no access to this throne of grace, mercy, and forgiveness. And if people at some level, if all people somewhere, sometime, or maybe all the time, really do need God's forgiveness, you know, to live the fully healed life, then the answer that has to be given, even for those folks who don't want to talk about it when they come into counsel, your hunch is, if they did want to open up on that spiritual thing, I wouldn't be surprised, I would expect that they'd say they too need forgiveness. And if not Jesus, then somebody like Jesus is the one or the message they need, they would like to hear. So what I've done then is zeroed more on that second question, and maybe with that we could move into the half sheet and just start walking down through it. I did also a little review in that sheet of what we did the very first session, since there may be nobody here who was at the Monday session. And in that first session, I said, why Jesus? What's sort of the New Testament's own answer in the various New Testament books? And I made the point that when the New Testament folks said, what we've got is good news, call it gospel, they were aware that there were alternate good newses being promoted in their day. Primarily two big ones, one from the own Jewish heritage that they themselves came from, Rabbinic Judaism, and Paul had been one of those, and they had all been insiders of that and had at least moved to another stage of, if you will, Messianic Jesus Judaism, and convinced that they had heard something that was good and new that they had never heard before in their Jewish heritage. The other one was sort of the standard Greek philosophical religious world of the non-Jewish community, where the focus was on intellect, insight, knowledge, and the skills that come from then how you can manage your life when you've got, you know, got your head together, as folks today say today. A sample of that first one, verbatim, that the Christians said, we've got something in this good news that we never heard before and was never as good and never as new, is one of Paul's own statements in the very first sermon he preaches on his first missionary journey, where in talking to the synagogue people of Israel, in Antioch of Pisidia, after a long introduction about David, he then says, let it be known therefore, brethren, that through this Jesus that I preach, there now is forgiveness of sins, John's word right now, for everybody. And by Jesus, everyone who trusts him is freed from all those things that you could never be freed if you just went by the law of Moses. Now here's a Jew saying, you know, nothing wrong with Moses, but here's something that Jesus does. He gets us forgiveness on those turfs where even Moses, the law, can't help us. And that is both good, and that was new for a Jew. Well, there's something parallel. Those two points are parallel when Paul then later on preaches to Hellenistic, Greek, quote, pagan audiences, and later in the book of Acts, and especially in those letters of St. Paul, like 1 Corinthians, where he's addressing letters to Christians who have now developed, or congregations that have developed in that Greek world, where the old Greek gospel, in quotation marks, keeps coming back in and making its pitch on those folks, and they're being drawn to it. He shows, you know, as good as all that might be, there's something super good about this Jesus, and super new that you never get from the Greco-Roman Gospels of the day. Okay. Have you got a sheet way back there? Huh. Is it close enough to one?
We can share one.
You two share. Okay, here. And then you share. Let's just go around the back of the room with folks reading number one, and then 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think there are 10 items, and it's on two sides of the sheet.
Okay.
Your name is?
Larry.
Larry.
Review of session number one. In the New Testament times, the Christian gospel did three things that other gospels of the day didn't. A, it diagnosed people's problems to be even deeper than the other two did.
Just to stop, the other gospels would look not just at people's surface behavioral and relational problems, but also would go deeper, you know, what's attitude, what's going on, but they never pushed what I'd call the third agenda, what's the God problem that you've really got, your God relationship, you know, how is it in trouble, or what is it, what fixing does it need?
B, he claimed to have healing for that deepest of all problems, namely, the crucified and risen Jesus.
No, yeah, Jesus is not the problem, he's the healing.
C, it offered the healing as an absolute freebie, with no prerequisites and no post-requisites either.
I suppose most of you would agree that there were no prerequisites. You know, if it's by grace alone, that doesn't mean, well, you gotta do this first before you get it. And I'm being very Pauline, like Paul now, and saying, and you know, when you really look at it, there are no post-requisites either. There are no things you got to do afterwards. And for that, Paul always says it's freedom. Grace is no prerequisites. Freedom is no post-requisites. I mean, Christians do live different lives, but they aren't you got to kind of different lives, as though they're requirements. Continue, yeah, please.
I missed this part of your talk last time, but from reading the handout, isn't faith a prerequisite? I mean, isn't there something you have to do to have this healing? You have to actually do something.
Carl, put that sheet on the chair. I'm going to do something to you. Get both hands free. Now people watch. Carl, here, catch! I just gave Carl a freebie gift. Now, what did he have to do in order to receive it? He had at least had to hold his hands open. But would you say that that was a prerequisite? I said, Carl, if you don't hold your hand open, I ain't going to throw it. A gift has to be received, but the reception is no sort of performance action requirement on the part of the receiver. Now, this may be a little hokey, but at least that's the point I want to make. Any free gift, your wife promises to love you until death us do part, you've got to receive that promise somehow, or otherwise, you know, it goes over your shoulder like this wallet. You could have said, uh-oh, he looks like, you know, a terrorist. I think I saw him in Oklahoma City. What he's throwing at me, I'm going to bypass and step aside because I don't want to hang on to that.
Wow. So, okay, just to clarify.
Faith is indeed an action, but this action was generated by the gift itself, right?
Right, but I can't will that to happen. It's, in other words, you had to throw this to me.
I have to initiate it. The giver, the Christ, the high priest has to initiate the action. God has to throw the mercy at us, otherwise we got nothing to catch. Or in the language of the letter of the Hebrews, where there's this holy place where God's mercy is, if it's veiled, if there's a curtain in front of it, somebody's got to turn the curtain open.
So, just to clarify, if we don't see it coming at us, I mean, if it doesn't get thrown to us, we're stuck,
right?
And if it is thrown to us, we have, it's almost an automatic reflexive response. And so it almost sounds Calvinistic. It almost sounds like...
Well, Calvin wasn't all wrong.
You are.
I'm not all wrong.
No, it almost sounds like you're either predestined to get something thrown to you that you can't escape notice of, or you're predestined to not ever see it.
Okay, bracket that till we get to the back of the page and see if it gets touched.
You want
Look, see, he's got no faith in me. Here's a freebie. You know, all the credit cards, all the greenbacks. You know, he's an unbeliever, so he caught it. He still doesn't believe it. way in the back row, would you take number two?
Me?
Yeah, you please.
The diagnosis of the letter to the Hebrews, A, starts at the observable level of people's behavioral problems and relationship problems. However, it does not yet offer help at the level, but B, pushes the diagnosis deeper to the interior sickness underlying such things, people's attitudes, ambitions, hopes, fears, hates, faith, their exhausted heart.
Okay, I'm trying to just diagram this. Some of you, Carl at least was here last week when I used this pattern for a Bible study in the Gospel of Luke, that Jesus in Luke regularly works a kind of a three-step diagnosis, and we call it x-ray. First of all, kind of a surface x-ray, you know, well, what are people's problems? You know, well, they got hurtful behaviors, hurting themselves, and their relationships with folks are screwed up. Underlying those behaviors are things going on the inside. Bible word for what's going on the inside, or the center of the inside, is the heart. It doesn't mean this cardiac muscle, it means sort of the center of my inner self. And that's where there are deeper problems. Example, your child has a fever. You don't just say the kid's too cold, too hot, I'll put him in the fridge, you know, until it comes down. You don't just treat the outer symptom. You say the symptom has a cause, and you may even get down here and say, you know, that deeper cause is itself a symptom of some deeper still cause. Well, that's the tripartite. So to diagnose deeper, that the New Testament regularly uses when it's saying, what's the trouble with people? Why are people hurting? And why are people hurting people? So in the writer of the letter of the Hebrews, he could be a she. There's no indication that it wasn't a woman. Takes a look at the behaviors of these burned out Christians, which we mentioned before, and then looks inside at their drooping faith, their exhausted hearts, their lack of any more confidence in this high priest that they used to be hooked on, and they're looking for other high priests, and particularly the Levitical ones. So they probably were Jewish Christians who were somehow saying, you know, it was better when we were doing the Jewish business. There we had some more solid stuff, and that seemed to work better, or whatever. So at least in the heart, they are shifting, or they're being pulled to shift. Now, but continue, but the diagnosis doesn't even, and another point. It's not that once you get this far, the writer says, okay, and for this level of the problem, here's solution. Nor even when you get down here, does it first of all say, and for this level of the problem, we got even a deeper solution. But it goes all the way to the root problem, if you will, the root sickness, offers treatment for that with the conviction that if that root gets treated, there'll be healing coming back up the pike. Just as if your kid, you know, really has been eating too much tofu here at Holden, and that causes some kind of stomach discombobulation, and that leads then, you know, to fevers or to sort of to vomiting. That probably isn't a good example. Forget about that. Go on.
See, here too, Hebrews does not yet offer help, but pushes to a third, deepest of all level. Sickness in our relationship with the God. The simple word for forgiveness is the fixer. But says Hebrew, sinners have no access to the mercy of God. It's blocked off by some curtain, just like the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem temple was blocked off from sinners.
Okay. In number one that Larry read, I said the first thing that the Christian good news does, it says before we propose our healing, we're going to have to do deeper diagnosis. At least deeper diagnosis than most of the going therapies of our day, the New Testament era, do. Because they seldom ever get or are concerned about, if you will, the God relationship. They may well say, no, we know that behaviors and things on the outside come from bad things on the inside, and so we got to move there for treatment. But the scripture says even the things that are on the inside of folks, the bad things, the sick things, are rooted in how we are or are not related to God. And from that grows then, you might say, what's inside, and from what's inside grows what's outside. I'm using the word grow, taking one of Jesus' favorite images, a tree. You know, he says if the fruits of the tree are bad, you don't just scold the tree and say, bear better fruits.
But if the fruits are sick, the tree is sick. And if the tree is sick, it's probably because the roots are sick. And so if you want to fix it, you either got to re-root the tree or find better roots, you know, for that tree to grow from. And that triad would be what I'm trying to suggest here. The roots, or if you want to use Paul Tillich's language, the ground, where we're grounded, you know, where our feet are in the ground, what grows from that grounding, and then what fruits come off of that plant. So some of you are probably thinking, you know, I've been to a lot of sermons, I bet, where the diagnosis only goes this far. And then the preacher says, now instead of that, do this, because Jesus said so. Now that's like taking somebody who's got a fever and putting him in the deep freeze until he comes down to 98.6. Because that's only symptom. I shouldn't say only, but that is symptom of something that's deeper. And we all know that. I mean, you and I know at least these first two levels. That's just common sense. At least nowadays, that's common sense. You know, attitudes create behaviors. And so if you're going to heal the whole business, you got to work on both. And except for behavioral mod, other therapies say, in fact, you even have to start here. And behavioral mod, I think, in a sense, even does start here. It said, you'd sooner be rewarded than punished, wouldn't you? You'd sooner have it feel good rather than feel bad. That's already something, at least minimally internal. Okay, so not until you get to that depth diagnosis does the Christian good news really have an agenda to talk to, I mean, the Jesus figure, because he doesn't say, I'm just a teacher of better ethics, or even I'm just a therapist to get you to have wholesome and better and fruitful attitudes inside. You know, I came to fix your God relationship. You know, the Son of Man has came to seek and to save the lost. Lost means the people that are not just kind of floating around, but are lost to God, and who need their God lostness fixed. Or another phrase, if we are dead in trespasses and sins, you know, as sort of old-fashioned as that may sound, then that means there's something corpse-like about our relationship to God, dead. And only somebody who somehow got some life juice is a likely candidate to be able to help us there. Or if we're in bondage to sin, imprisoned, you know, nobody who's behind bars is on his or her own ever going to get out on by themselves. Somebody's got to come from the outside and open the door or saw the bars down. Once in a while there's a jailbreak, but that's very rare. And at least from this jail, nobody ever breaks out on their own. Okay, move on. Number three then.
Jesus is the high priest who opened the curtain to the mercy seat, God's throne of grace, God's forgiveness. Yes, it was costly. Cost him his own blood, his life. Yet in raising him from the dead, God announces that Jesus' curtain opener is okay, and that it'll last forever. There is permanent access to mercy for any and all sinners.
Okay, these two items, number two and number three, are rather, you know, a condensed analysis of the letter to the Hebrews. The number two item here was, you know, how Hebrews analyze, diagnosis, what the problem is of those poor Hebrew Christians. And the one you just read is the good news that the writer says, here's what we got going for us that'll help at every one of these places. I mean, first of all, it'll help at the deep place. We need to get our sins forgiven. We need to get mercy. We need to get access to God as merciful. Hebrews says, apart from Jesus, God's a flaming fire. That's one of those real brusque statements in the book of Hebrews. And you may recall that the whole Old Testament notion is that if a sinner, an uncovered sinner, ever got next to God, especially face to face, what would happen? Zap! You know, a sinner would become a cinder. That's a bit corny. But that's the Old Testament perspective, that God's holiness and human sinfulness just can't be in the same place at the same time. And it's obvious that a sinner's sinfulness is not going to push God out of the way. Well, then the opposite's going to happen. Do you recall Isaiah in his so-called inaugural vision, chapter 6, when he gets his assignment? He has this incredible vision. He's in the temple. He may well have been even a priest in the Jerusalem priesthood. And suddenly the temple's filled with smoke, and he looks over the high altar, and there's God sitting. And Isaiah's first response is not, hallelujah, I've had a theophany, you know, I've got a God appearance. But he says, woe is me, I'm a dead duck, I'm a sinner, and I see God face to face. That's death for guys like me. And then God tells one of the flapping beasties, they really weren't angels, they're seraphs with six wings, says, here, take one of the burning coals that's on the altar. Isaiah probably had just offered a sacrifice, you know, if he was a priest, as is likely. He says, take one of those burning coals and singe him on the lurch. That's many dying, many being turned to cinder. And then God says, okay, with that I have purged you. You know, that's his forgiveness of sins. And God says, and now that your lips are purged, now you do my kind of talking. And go to these folks and tell them, blah, 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 blah. Okay, apart from Christ, the letter to the Hebrews, and much of the Old and New Testament says, it's not good news to bump into God if you're a sinner. And apart from Christ, says the scriptures, all of us still are. Okay, let's move on. Next one.
Power. So why Jesus? Answer. He's the only one known so far to have attempted such a job and succeeded. On Easter, he got God's approval for his work on the project. That takes care of the sickness of diagnosis C above.
Well, yeah, well, I put 1, 2, 3 here. Now I realize in my little notes there I had, that's A, diagnosis, behavior, relations, people you might see on the outside. You could just say, you know, relationships, my relationships to the outside. People, things, the environment, the planet, trees. B, you might say a set of relationships on the inside. You know, what's going on inside me? I'll just put, you know, outside. Well, I can do that. Outside, inside. Okay, we'll call this God's side. That's A, B, and C. Okay, Jesus, the good news about Jesus is that he addresses this and heals it. At least that's the Christian claim.
Okay, after that, B and A sicknesses are healable too. Drooping hearts, that's the B diagnostic. Discouraged by their sins, failures, shame, etc., are encouraged, enter in to God's mercy through the open curtain. Hebrews calls that access by trusting Jesus as high priest and not some other Levitical one. Such trust in God's forgiveness, mercy, through Jesus, the author and finisher of the Access Project, brings healing in the realm of the A diagnostic, our behaviors and relationships of our life in the world.
The image I'm following, I mean, the perspective I'm following is the one about Jesus, about a sick plant all the way down, or sick tree. Once it gets rerooted into whole, healed, healthy, saved rootage, then, you know, new growth of the stock or the stem or the trunk is a natural. And to be sure, and from that new growth comes new fruits, new behaviors, new ways to live in the world. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, and now 5.
So where does therapy fit in? Therapy can be helpful in healing on the A and B levels of our lives. It has no access to the C level unless our therapist actually speaks of our hang-ups in terms of the root in our God problem. And if the therapist does move to that deepest diagnosis, the only healing he or she could offer would be to tell us, as Hebrew does, about Jesus the High Priest.
Okay, that's maybe my biggest statement, John, that you were looking for. You know, how do you think they might be related, or how in your own head do you do it? And here's my way of thinking, that now you claim therapists never touch this, at least they ought not to, the third level, especially since they're science.
If I had made that statement, I want to retract.
Okay, but as scientists, they contend themselves to these two terms when you make the distinction between science and gospel. And I don't want to challenge you. I want to say, did I get you right? Well, that therapy is
okay. I also made another statement that when I talked about behaviorists, I left out therapy, and one of the things that, you know, counseling kind of therapy, which may or may not be based on behavioral theory. I would suggest that behavioral theory has something to do with almost all therapy, but it's not the whole thing.
It's all eventually concerned with what I call here the agenda.
And the other thing that we did talk about the other day that you have not yet mentioned.
And you haven't either, was Carl Jung.
Well, Carl Jung, but also talked about people like Morton Kelsey.
All right.
People like Scott Peck, other people who have looked at the whole issue. But as Larry suggests here, this is something that he will give people a choice about.
Yeah.
Well, and I still don't understand why we're comparing the two.
Well, we're comparing the two because I know some people who think their therapist is Jesus and say, I don't need Jesus anymore.
Well,
so they have heard a gospel, a good news from that treatment, and you know, you can see lots of good things are happening to them. So for me, gospel is a word without a capital letter, really. A good news that people have received.
Okay, but gospel is something that proclaimed by the person writing the gospel. Jesus proclaimed this gospel. I would suggest to you that the people that have been to a therapist and think they've seen Jesus, that comes from within them. That the therapist is not, and certainly should not be, sitting there and saying that I am God.
No, obviously, yeah, I agree with that. But I would still think that at least therapy that uses language, and that's most all that I know of, is proclaiming. The therapist is proclaiming. He's giving you a proposal, a message, first of all, about your own sickness. And he urges you to understand that and finally to say yes to at least to the diagnosis that he thinks or she thinks she can see there. That comes close at least to what at the initial of what faith means. Faith means to say yes to someone else's words about you. Right. And conversely, the therapist says, and now besides this analysis of your sickness, you know, there's help available. And I know some of the things about that help, and here's at least some things I'd like to hold before you, or I'd like to have you discover for yourself, but you know, I would try to lead you through that. For me, that's at least gospel, lowercase g, of good news for people who are hurting.
Well, you seem to just be setting up a kind of illness paradigm here. And what I want to suggest to you is that a perfectly well person psychologically, I still have a very great interest in God and my spirit and the spiritual side of my life, which has nothing to do at all with my psychological. Well, I shouldn't say nothing to do at all, but I mean, it's not through out of illness that I seek closeness with God.
It's not out of this kind of illness, but it is out of this kind of illness.
Well, I think that's what I'm having difficulty with.
Calling that illness.
That you're mixing two things here.
Well, I know John and I shouldn't carry on our debate in front of you folks. You're here for maybe some, but that may be helpful. I think that from Genesis chapter 3 all the way to Revelation 22, which is, you know, the whole Bible, except those first two chapters, it's a story about sickness and healing. You know, big sickness and big healing. Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 3 blow it, and from that time on their lives are sick with God. I mean, their life with God is sick, sick, sick. In fact, it's mortally sick. And the cosmos is in trouble too, at least this planet. And it gets cursed because of those characters. You know, whatever all those words mean in the original context. And so the healing metaphor is, I think, at the center of the whole biblical story. Especially understanding that in both Latin, in both Hebrew and Greek, the word to heal and to save are the same verb. And so healing and saving is the same stuff. And it really isn't, you know, saving people for go to heaven. It's healing people down here on the ground in all three of, let's call them, what I would call the primordial relationships that humans have. That God created us with these three, if you will, primordial relationships, you know, right from the word go. We're related to other people and things. We also have a kind of relation to ourselves and self-perception, self-awareness, self-understanding. And the root of it all, or the ground of it all, is that God created us and we've got a relationship with God. And when any human is sinful or sick, all three of the relationships get sick. And whole healing, total healing would be when all three of them would be made well again. Well, maybe that will come through here more. Maybe it won't, but let's just finish off and see if we got a little time yet for conversation. Whoever's next, what do you want to do, 9-6?
6. In the profession of therapy today, that is still mostly a no-no.
Maybe it's still mostly a no-no for the therapist himself to start talking about Jesus, just to put it very simply. Okay.
Contrary to the rules of the guild, if some therapists should nevertheless do that, it could only be those who are themselves linked to that high priest in the way that Hebrews recommends.
Like Larry, and probably many others, but ones who say, I anticipate that you may well have a problem there. I won't say that out loud, but I do anticipate that. And if you want to open that can up, I'll be willing to see what worms crawl out and see if I can help you with those worms. And I gather Larry does it as a Christian. He doesn't say, well, Buddha's pretty good. Why don't you try him? But
I would suggest to you that Buddhists could benefit from therapy, and he could benefit from looking at Buddhism as part of his spiritual life to make him right with himself and with his concept of God.
Now, what makes you think I would deny that?
Well,
I'll say that tomorrow morning. And I'm just going to say, in what sense does Jesus have anything different for healing than what the Gautama Buddha offers to Buddhist believers? And if I could, you can probably guess, I'm going to say, how deep does the Buddha tradition or the Buddha quote theology analyze the human malady? And it goes pretty deep. I don't think it goes this deep. And what kind of healing does the Eightfold Path and the Fivefold Way offer? And it offers lots. Okay, press on.
If therapists stick to the A and B levels of diagnosis,
that means, you know, this stuff up here, people's behaviors and what's going on inside that's related to all that, but not the God side.
They can indeed bring real help to patients. If, however, the C level sickness remains untreated, the healing at the A and B levels is incomplete. A gospel truster will not be surprised when forms of A and B symptoms show up again.
At least that's my claim. That if we are whole human beings and units, not really three parts, and that we live in this three relational reality, if healing only comes to us at level A and level B, and C remains unhealed, then eventually either some of the old sicknesses in the A and B, or different forms of A and B sickness will arise. For example, someone who was convinced of his or her own worthlessness and then comes to Christ and gets renewed and forgiven can then somehow say, now the new way of life I've got is the way all of you have to have. And in this case, a publican has just been turned into a Pharisee. Jesus talked about when the cleansing of the devils happens, there's no guarantee that different devils will come back in. And I'm not saying, you know, So therapy's no good. I'm just saying, if the healing hasn't healed all facets of the problem, especially the deep one, then you shouldn't be surprised if total healing hasn't happened yet and other forms of sickness reoccur. Now, once more, that's not to say therapy is no damn good. That's just to say, if it's 3 miles, you know, from, or if it's 11 miles from here to the Lucerne, And the bus breaks down after 8 miles. Well, it was great that you got 8 miles, but there was still 3 more to go to catch the boat.
I don't think I know of a single person who proclaims his or her Christianity who has been forever cured of lusts and greeds and ambitions, fears, and other such behaviors.
Right.
And we're always backsliding, so I don't understand how hearing it, I haven't seen any example of a person who's been irrevocably cured and where the symptoms don't appear again.
Now, my snotty remark is, Carl, you're hanging around with Calvinists too much. You should see Lutherans who really never get cured. Sure, and the Hebrews writer is addressing that. These folks were once healed and put on the path to follow this high priest, you know, for the homeland. And on the way, they get plumb tuckered out, and they want to move a little move aside. And so what has to, it's a repetition over and over again. They have to be brought back. Somebody has to preach to them, if you will, hey, remember our high priest? Did you forget the picture? The door is open. And they say, oh yeah, I know that, but you know, right now I wasn't living on that. I was living on some other energy. So this is in no sense a proposal to say, you know, once you bump into Jesus and trust him, to mix metaphors, it's nirvana from then on.
So
no
the
way.
Symptoms can, will, can and will come
oh,
back.
Oh, they do, yeah. And, but
even when you're cured at the third level.
Indeed, and then the question is, how do you respond? How do you cope when it comes back again? Do you cope by saying, all I need to do is to shape up my act? Or to say, no, all I need, really need to do is just to, you know, refocus my heart and my attitudes. The letter of Hebrews says, no, all you got to do is you got to start at the bottom again and get re-rooted. And over again. Luther's little catechism about baptism makes a paradigm out of that. He says, what does it mean to be baptized? He says, well, baptized means, if you will, we get hooked in to the high priest or to Jesus the healer. And then Luther says, okay, and then what do you do the next day? Every day you do it all over again. What does baptism signify? What's the sign so that it's on your head once you get baptized? The sign is that every day old sinful Ed's going to wake up in the morning too, and old sinful Ed's going to have to be crucified today too, so that old sinful Ed can rise and be Christ's new man again today. And by golly, tomorrow I'll have to have it all over again. Now there may be, you know, some progress in the sense of there's growth that day, but there's never, it never is perfect until the day I kick the bucket. And if you don't believe that, I haven't kicked the bucket yet. Talk to my wife.
Well, I keep putting these buckets out.
I do have, but there are about three of these left. Let's finish these, and then we'll have, I won't have any agenda anxiety, and, which shows that I'm really not living by that good news either. Eight. Number eight, whoever, who's next? You're next.
My name.
Go ahead now. Yeah, well, I'm going to bump up here. No, Carl's talked enough. Not only today, by the way.
Me?
Please, yes, sir.
Right. Eight. An offertory collect in the LBW has us dedicating our lives to the care and redemption of all that you, God, have made. Today's forms of therapy bring healing to the A and B diagnoses. That is part of God's caring for creation carried out by people. Redemption is the word for healing of the C diagnosis. That too can be offered to a seasick people by other people. It happens when seasick persons meet up with Jesus the High Priest. Christian language for that offer is the proclaimed gospel and the sacraments. When the healing actually gets to the patient, the Christian word for what's happening is faith.
I'm taking those two words from that great collect. I only discovered that, even though I've recited it, you know, probably 100 times or hundreds of times. I only discovered it a year or two ago that those two words, care and redemption, are not really synonyms, even though they're both, you know, good words, good sounding words. But that care of creation is to keep it going and to heal it in terms of if, what I call, you know, sort of the A and the B agenda. But redemption, the literal meaning of redemption is to regain ownership. Emptor is the word for to buy or to own. Rid emptor is to own again. God's ownership, regaining ownership, you know, of sinners, in fact, of his whole world, only happens through, you know, this strange high priest, just to use the language of Hebrews. And therefore, you won't redeem any situation or any human being, says the Christian gospel, unless you somehow get him or her connected to that high priest again. But the care of creation to keep it from just going to hell in a handbasket is clearly done by, you know, medical healing and therapeutic psychiatric healing and school teachers healing ignorance in students, and, you know, all the so-called helping professions. They do indeed do that, and it's godly work.
Even environmentalists.
Well, I don't know. If Carl, you could be saved, it would be by grace alone. Right. But none of that, as good as it is, you know, ever gets sinners forgiven. It may open them up, soften them up, and somebody's finding you, you've got to do or say explicit gospel to them, you know, explicit Jesus talk, or sacramental, or whatever. You know, somebody has to throw the wallet. Not just say, hey, there is a wallet, I hope you can find it. It's got to be given. Next.
Number 9. In the rough and tumble of today's world, some therapies claim that there is no such thing as a C agenda at all. It's not so much that they might be called atheists, but that they proclaim people have no C level God problem. At this point, they conflict with the Christian good news.
It's my reading of Freud, that Freud was one like that. I don't know if there are any therapists. I don't know personally any therapists today who do that, who do this.